Resorts, homes, and a newly built hospital have been washed away.
No electricity, nothing whatsoever.
We need to be prepared for the future.
I'm just holding on for dear life here. This isn't fun.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Plan this time before disaster strike.
Every natural disaster gets worse.
What happens when something goes wrong and how do they respond to it?
And make sure everyone's safety comes first.
Save what for dream. You must ready.
Clearing roads, restoring critical infrastructure.
Eventually, I know it's going to hit. It's only a matter of time.
Helping your community.
Helping your family.
Helping you.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Prepared. I'm Fred Hooper. We've got a great team of reporters who are on the ground chatting to you, and the stories that we bring you could help you, your family, and your community prepare for natural disasters. The weather and how it affects you is already part of your life, so let's keep talking about being prepared. On today's show, a New Zealand researcher has been diving at the site of the volcanic eruption in Tonga.
But this eruption is rewriting the rules on what we think is theoretically possible.
Find out what that might mean for future disaster warnings. And memories from volcanoes passed down using stories. The technology might be different now, but the stories probably won't change. And find out how organisations in Vanuatu are using the money on the ground. That's all coming up. This is Pacific Prepared.
Save what for dream. You must ready. Pacific Prepared.
There's something nice about when the old and the new come together, like the way that information was passed down through stories. Pacific Prepared producer and freelance journalist Gina Kakia found this out recently. Gina retells a story from a father to his son about a volcanic eruption and what it was like for him.
The Kurukanal people in the mountains stood outside their houses watching the spectacle lit up as though by daylight, and millions of great fiery rocks, red like the moon, were thrown into the sky above the fire.
As you'll hear, even though modern technology has changed the way that volcanoes are studied, the stories are still going to be the same.
It was 1927 when Sugati, the father of Marin Tandapara of Takamboru village on Kurukanal, told his 12-year-old son about the eruption of Savo. Sugati was between the ages of 80 to 100 when he retold the story to his son. This he had seen from his hill village on Kurukanal a lifetime before. He said it was before the white man came to Kurukanal and the Ngalina time of the year, which was between June to July. The old man said very heavy rain had fallen on Savo that day, and he thought this might have something to do with the volcano, as there were also earthquakes felt on Kurukanal at that time. He said it started in the evening in a small way at first, but at midnight there were sounds like the continued hooting of a steamer and also like a river in flood rolling large boulders against each other. The sounds of many muffled concussions. This became louder and he felt earthquake shocks like repeated thumping. Then came the outburst. The Kurukanal people in the mountains stood outside their houses watching the spectacle lit up as though by daylight, and millions of great fiery rocks, red like the moon, were thrown into the sky above the fire on Savo, falling into the surrounding illuminated sea. Some fell on Kurukanal near Visale and ashes covered jungle leaves, the ground and gardens between Doma and Kuisau. The explosion continued into the day with hot rocks being ejected from the volcano. Following the eruption, the Kurukanal people flocked from the hilltop villages to the beach. There they found many Savo people who managed to escape by canoe. Everyone were kind to them. Sugati's story was one of many similar oral stories told from generation to generation describing the eruption of Savo, which as of July last year continued to show increased seismic activity.
The worries that we had was that because of the enhanced volcanic seismic activity, what the geology department did was that they've been carrying out assessments right all through last year. Even this year, they still what are also doing too.
Dr. Melchior Mataki is chairman of the National Disaster Council, NDC. NDC was established in 1989 to deal with natural disasters. The council chair sits in the Ministry of Environment as permanent secretary. With the enhanced seismic activity happening on the island of Savo, the council has reasons to be worried. The island of Savo is home to almost 3,000 Solomon Islanders.
The monitoring aspect has to be really there because the signals, blow, seismic activity would be picked up fast. And so this is the reason why we know we really wanted the monitoring and observation process for him stay in place so that at least we have some lead time, you know, in our reach, outreach to the people has always been based on, you know, if you see these signs and whatnot, then it's better to start moving.
Not until recently, the seismology division was boosted with latest equipment from the U.S. government, as well as through a project called CRISP a few years back. CRISP was supported mostly by the World Bank. Solomon Posse works in the seismology division. I spoke to him a while ago on behalf of CRISP. He said having up-to-date equipment to support them in their day-to-day work has really boosted their work in terms of monitoring seismic activities.
We have installed two surveillance cameras, webcam for volcano monitoring as well. So we record live image from the volcano sites. They are transmitted to our monitoring room, which we can see visual image from the volcano. Volcano, like one in Savo and the other in Tinakula in the Temwatu province. So this has helped us a lot. Like in the past, we don't have volcano surveillance cameras, so we don't know what's happening out there, especially at the volcano. So we can record the volcanic events like tremors and also see the live image.
Savo is a stratovolcano. Stratovolcano is said to be very violent and explosive when it erupts. It has the tendency to hurl volcanic bombs in the process.
Savo, for example, the old people are very aware of the issues that they have on the island, although I think the young people may not really be attuned to the risks that are there. I hope with the recent activities experienced, I think it should also help in heightening their awareness that there is this risk that they are faced with and that the country as a whole is also faced with it. When our teams went out to the communities, that they were saying, oh, we've seen these things, strange happenings that points to a certain activity that, you know, they cannot really point to clearly, but most likely linked to potential volcanic eruption, you know, or the volcano, yes, yeah.
A potential volcanic eruption on the island of Savo will definitely impact the western side of Kodokanal, including Honiara, the capital city. The boat ride from Honiara to Savo takes less than an hour. One cannot imagine the chaos and panic this will cause should the volcano erupt.
There is generally a very kind of indifference to preparedness work. It's not really considered to be important, especially from a resourcing and financing point of view, preparedness work. Why you are holding awareness-raising workshops and all these workshops? On, you know, there is a general mentality that, oh, this, why are you having these workshops? It's not addressing these things. You need to have that to bring in people, to raise awareness and whatnot. So preparedness work, you know, just, not just workshops, but having to set up plans in place, you know, if there is if we needed to evacuate, what is it that you need to do? What are the steps that you can do? So preparedness work is not really, there is a lot of indifference to it. But research elsewhere has shown that every single dollar that you spend on preparedness work actually save you $7 to $8 of response. That mindset has to change as well. People are more accustomed to respond to something and react to something. Oh, now we have a cyclone and it's caused this much of damage or whatnot. But what's important is what you do before that. What you do before that. Where do you build your houses? What kind of protective measures are you taking? Are you building strong houses? Are you building on areas that are supposed not to be built on in the first place? Are you taking your houses right up to the hills where it's close to the volcano? These are decisions that every one of us do on a daily basis. So it's not that kind of preparedness work that you need for doing. Everybody has to take that responsibility, and not just the state. The public also has to take that responsibility so that it assists everybody do their bit to assist the overall state of preparedness.
That's the producer of this program and freelance journalist in Solomon Islands, Gina Kakia, with that story.
What's your plan? Are you ready to leave your home? Plan now before disaster strikes. Pacific Prepared.
There's always organisations and governments talking about disaster preparations and where their money is going into different programs. But what does it actually look like in a practical sense? Vanuatu reporter Florence Fanua spoke with some of the organisations involved to find out a little more.
Oxfam Vanuatu, through the Australian Humanitarian Partnership's Disaster Ready Program, has been working with communities in Vanuatu's Shefa province to set up community disaster climate change committees, or CTCCCs, educate people about disaster preparedness and responses, and establishing the communications between the Shefa Provincial Government Council and the Vanuatu National Disaster Management Office. Glenn Pakoa, the Vanuatu Humanitarian Team Coordinator at Oxfam Vanuatu, says to prepare communities for disasters, Oxfam Vanuatu helps communities to set up these disaster committees to help them prepare for and respond to disasters.
For Oxfam, the AHP Disaster Ready Program started a few years back. I think it was around 2017 that the program started for Oxfam. So basically, for us here at Oxfam, we're working at three levels, which is the community level, the provincial level, and the national level. Types of activities we carry out at the community level is basically a capacity building community members through the what we call CDCCCs. It's the abbreviation for Community Disaster and Climate Change Committees. Firstly, when we whenever we go into communities, we try to set up these CDCCCs, and it is very important to have representations from both women, men, and youth groups who are involved in these CDCCs. We conduct trainings, capacity building trainings on the roles and responsibilities of the CDCCs, what to do in times of disaster preparedness, preparing for disasters, what to do during disasters, and what to do when there is a need for a disaster response.
Mr. Pakoa also says Oxfam Vanuatu, through the Disaster Ready Program, conducted disaster drills to educate people to prepare for tsunamis, floodings, and cyclones.
Pango is located, as we all know, Pango is located in a coastal area on Efate, so it is very prone to disasters and floodings, especially in times of cyclones. And we also conducted other drills, cyclone drills for communities around Efate and Shepherd Outer Islands. Regarding the cyclone drills, we our main focus is for communities to have cyclone-proof housing, evacuation centers that people need to be evacuated to when a cyclone strikes. The CDCCs need to have the capacity in place in order to carry out these activities. And from there, from the community level, we move up to the provincial level. We try to link the Shefa provincial government and the NDMO with the CDCCs, establishing this link, this connection, this communication channel, and strengthening it between the provincial government and the CDCCs. From our assessments, we found out that communities do not get that much support that they need from provincial government, and I think vice versa. It goes both ways. So we have signed MOAs, Memorandum of Agreement and Partnerships with the Shefa provincial government to support them to get the type of necessary information down to communities regarding disaster preparedness and response.
Cyrus Maldock, the Monitoring and Evaluation Officer at Oxfam Vanuatu, says Oxfam Vanuatu implemented its disaster-ready programs mainly in Vanuatu's Shefa province and has helped establish more than 20 active community disaster climate change committees in over 17 communities in Shefa province.
We undertake or we roll out our activities in three area councils, which is allocated for us. These three particular area councils are Pango Area Council, and we have Tanvasogo Area Council, and the third one is Eratap Area Council, including communities in Teoma and surrounding communities, as well as Etas. Yes, this is our working scoping. And we have engaged two other partners as well, which we work closely with them to implement the disaster-ready activities. The two partners are VTPA and One Small Pack. And they also have their own scoping or their own communities where they focus in implementing disaster-ready activities. One Small Pack focuses more on Epi Island in one area council in Epi. They also do similar activities such as what we are doing here in Evate. Yes, so basically these are some activities that we are currently doing, mostly on disaster preparedness and disaster response.
Cyrus Maltok, Oxfam Vanuatu's Monitoring and Evaluation Officer, and Glenn Pakoa, the Vanuatu Humanitarian Team Coordinator at Oxfam Vanuatu.
Vanuatu Pacific Prepared reporter Florence Fanua with that story.
Be informed.
Be ready. Pacific Prepared.
After one of the biggest volcanic eruptions in recent history, all of a sudden, scientists from across the world were looking at Tonga. It offered so much information up to scientists, to learn more about volcanoes in general, but also to help create better warning systems. This is Professor Shane Cronin, a volcanologist from New Zealand. He spoke with Pacific Prepared reporter Anasiu Falakono.
So we know Tonga has erupted in recent times. So in the most recent eruptions were 2009, and there was another one in 2014-15. And so this event began in the same way. It began something like the 20th or 19th of December of 2021, and the activity was similar to before. And what's been happening since then, it became slightly larger and slightly larger during January, and then, of course, the very big day for the eruption, which was a horrifying event with the explosions, the tsunami waves, and also the ash, when everything became dark with the ashfall. So not only the impacts in Tonga were hugely felt, but also the impacts were felt around the world, because the tsunami from this eruption went across to Japan, to Korea, to South America as well. And so the event was worldwide. And one of the things that we first realized when we started looking at this eruption, it's one of the biggest eruptions that we have recorded on modern satellite instruments. So the eruption shot ash and gas and hot material up into the air. It reached more than 55 kilometers in the atmosphere and through the atmosphere into what we call the stratosphere above.
The ash from the eruption covered the main island of Tongatapu e Wahapai and only a small amount on the island of Avao. As a volcanologist, what caused the massive eruption?
It's very unusual for an eruption to be heard all around the other side of the world, to Alaska, or to I have colleagues in Switzerland who were measuring the earthquake shaking associated with this eruption, but also the air, the shock wave that went around the world went to them as well. So an incredibly large event. And we were worried because we had no communications with Tonga, and we were worried that there would be large numbers of fatalities. And thankfully, that has not been the case. And, you know, the Tonga is very, very fortunate in that there were several warning signs. First of all, natural warning signs. First of all, the small tsunami waves that began made people aware and to leave the beach. Then the explosions. Although they were very frightening, they were a very good warning signal for people to, this is something different, you know, get away from the beach, get away from the shore. And that was what saved people's lives. Because ashfall, you know, the ash falling around on the landscape, that is not necessarily going to be a fatal hazard. Mm. It's a nuisance. It's bad for crops, bad for plants, bad for water supply. But it's not, you know, in of itself a dangerous. But the tsunami are very dangerous. And these tsunami were huge. So we've been measuring in different parts of the country with our survey the height of the wave. So because everyone got away and got to high land, and when we go to small islands and we're looking, say, in Numuka, and we were talking to people about all of the places that they got to escape from the tsunami, and then we were taking our instruments and measuring very closely where the tsunami went, how high the wave was, and how high the run-up was. And we use this because we need to know for future how we can make a better forecast for tsunami, how we can make a better hazard assessment for tsunami. And one thing that we really learned from this experience is that the models that we have for the ash fall and the models that we have for tsunami are not working well. This is not just the problem for Hunga. This is not also just the problem for Tonga. All of the models. So the models for the ashfall come from the US. The models for the tsunami come from a range of different groups, from Japan, from USA, and so on. None of the models were working because this event was so much bigger and so much more violent than anything that we have seen in the past. So we can only really base our models on what we think is theoretically possible. But this eruption is rewriting the rules on what we think is theoretically possible.
Well, in Tonga, as you mentioned, you're working closely with a team from the Tonga Geology Department. What have you collected so far?
We're going around different parts of the country and we're measuring the height of the tsunami in the trees, how far the tsunami reached, how much ash was deposited. So we're taking samples of ash, either measuring small areas and collecting sample or measuring the thickness. And so we're trying to capture all this information before all the trees regrow, before the ash washes away, so that we can then work with the Americans, the Japanese, with all of these different groups in the UK and France that are coming together to provide better models for the hazard.
With many years of experience working as a volcanologist, and you've been in Tonga a few times now, why did the warning system did not predict the eruption?
Yeah, so there are two aspects of warning. One is the timing, you know, so when would something like this happen? And it's quite difficult because there aren't any seismographs that are working currently in Tonga. So we have some instruments that are being installed. The older instruments were gradually falling off service. So the only way that the team was able to monitor for specifically the timing of an eruption was to observe what was going on, and that always a reaction. So there's a reaction to it. There's no forecasting because we can't see what's happening below ground with seismographs. And so now that's being addressed. So new seismographs are being installed now, and there's a series of seismographs being donated through Australia that are going in to help improve that monitoring system. The other aspect of understanding the scale of eruption, as you describe, that comes from lived experience. So geologically speaking, you know, looking at it this from a geological perspective, we could say that this type of large eruption is possible from the volcano, because when we last studied this volcano in great detail at the end of 2015, and in fact we've just written science papers on this in the last few years, we discovered that not only were the eruptions just the small regular ones like we see, but there are some that are very large and produce extremely explosive events. Now we see that in the geologic deposits, and we see the ages of those, they happen once every 1,000 years at this volcano. So when we look at an eruption beginning, and it, and as we did in 2021, and we look at it and it looks like the past historical ones, we currently don't have any way of knowing how we go from that to the next gear to the really big ones. I will add, though, one important thing, which is really important for the people of Tonga, is that the volcano has fundamentally changed its shape. The volcano is still intact as a large submarine mountain, so it's hard to imagine that because the Hongas were just these two small islands, and they're even smaller now. But underneath the ocean waves is a big volcano, so it's like a big mountain. So that mountain is still standing, but instead of it having a fairly flat top, it now has a very large hole in the middle of it. And so that hole is at least 800 meters as far as we know. So the center of the volcano has completely collapsed in on itself. That means one really important thing, that the water in the middle is about 800 to 1,000 meters deep. If there is an eruption, the next eruptions will only be at the ocean floor because there's so much pressure of water holding that back, it can't erupt to the surface. So the reason it erupted to the surface in early this year is that the volcano top was only about 140 meters below sea level. So not enough water to hold it back, and in fact, lots of water to make it, the water is acting like fuel. New eruptions will be much more gentle. In fact, we probably won't even notice them because they'll be happening in the deep ocean floor.
New Zealand volcanologist Shane Cronin and Anasiu Falakono. And there's more of that conversation to be heard in coming episodes.
10 minutes after the earthquake, we heard a loud bang and then just saw the sea rising up.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do. Pacific Prepared.
Pacific Prepared is supported by the Pacific Media Assistance Scheme with funding from the Australian Government's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Any views expressed do not necessarily represent those of PACMAS or the Australian Government. It's produced and distributed in partnership with Radio Australia and networks across the Pacific, including Radio New Zealand Pacific, NBC Papua New Guinea, Palau Wave Radio, Capital FM 107 Vanuatu, FBC Fiji, Samoa National Radio 2AP, and TBC Tonga. Is your organisation working in disaster preparedness or resilience? Keep us informed so that we can keep everyone informed. Maybe you've got a story idea, a personal experience to share, a topic to cover, or someone we should meet. The easiest way to get in touch is to search for Pacific Prepared and then hit the Contact Us button. You can also listen back to the program. Just type Pacific Prepared into your search engine and you'll find us. Have conversations about disasters. What would you do and how would you prepare? We're trying to help you make the next disaster easier for you and your family. My name is Fred Hooper. Please share any information that you've learned today and stay safe. This has been Pacific Prepared.